Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We should prepare for the long term, the tensions and fixed confrontation.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, Akihiro Iwashita, professor at the Slavic Eurasian Research Center at Hokkaido University, joins Professor Rory Metcalf to discuss Japan's relationship with Russia and China. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past and present.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. This episode of the podcast features a special guest visiting us from Japan. It's fantastic to see Japanese scholars visiting Australia again as borders open for robust debate on the big strategic issues of the day. And our guest today is Professor Akihiro Iwashita, who is with the Slavic Eurasian Research Center at Hokkaido University. And I guess that's a way of saying that we have here today one of Japan's leading specialists, not only on Russia and Japan-Russia relations, but on the strategic challenges of the broader region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the National Security Podcast, Professor Iwashita.
Thank you for the great invitation. It's my pleasure.
So today I'm hoping we can speak not only about Russia and the Russia-Japan relationship and obviously the consequences of the invasion of Ukraine for that strategic dynamic, but I'm sure we'll also get to questions about China, Japan's relations with China, Russia-China relations. This is pretty important for our listeners in Australia and across the Indo-Pacific because I think too often we are trapped into a mindset that the strategic dynamics of our region are all about China and the United States, the US-China relationship. Whereas, of course, there's, I think, quite a compelling multipolarity at work in the future of the region and the world. And it's expertise like yours, grounded in a deep study of history, that I think unpacks that story for us. So if I may begin by asking you for your assessment of the current state of relations between Japan and Russia, and especially how that has been affected by the brutal invasion of Ukraine this year.
I think that since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the new Russia period, we enjoy the happy time, the kind of thaw time. Even the Japan had a dispute territory with Russian northern territories, but nevertheless, Gorbachev, Yeltsin, early Putin had good relation, diplomatic ties with Japan side. So particularly, I came from Hokkaido, the local areas, so mutual exchange, Sakhalin, the Kurils, the Russians, in a special basis because of our territorial disputes. But we had good contact. But after Russian invasion of Ukraine, everything has changed. A good 30 years expired. So now particularly the borderlands area of Japan stuck with little relation with Russian locals. So this is a very serious impact on Japan, I think. Of course, diplomatic relations is a bit different. Japan show a very, very strong will against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is a very good thing that because we Japanese always respect international law-based relations. Russia particularly and broke up the situation, good situation under the Cold War, post-Cold War period, and also influence basic international norms. So this kind of a difference we should keep in mind.
So I will provide a little bit of context here because probably not all of our listeners are familiar with the history of Japan-Russia relations. And of course, that for much of history, the last 100 years, the last 200 years, it's not been a happy history. So there are clearly unresolved issues between Russia and Japan. There have been attempts, as you say, towards a more positive conciliatory relationship in recent decades, and that presumably has been severely damaged by what's happened this year. Could you perhaps give us, in a nutshell, just a quick summary of Japan-Russia relations and why it's such a difficult relationship to resolve?
Oh, this is because it depends on the history. Dear Japan, the territory before the Meiji Restoration, not reached the Hokkaido, all of the Hokkaido itself. Then we also developed the North orientation to the peoples working with so-called Northern Territories, Kurils. But Russia also, empire, expand down to the Ohotsk or some Japan Sea places. Then we met these islands areas. But in the late of 19th century, we agreed to the demarcation. Then four islands near Hokkaido, it's Japanese. So that we said that in a kind of heritageous islands. But in Japan, they took Southern Kurils, as well as of Southern Sakhalin periods. Of course, after that, the Northern Kurils have been exchanged with South Sakhalins. It's peaceful negotiations. After that, war, Russo-Japanese war in 1904-5. Then Japan want to occupy South Sakhalin to colonize Japanese territories. But Putin's mind, kind of motion in Japan's aggression, therefore even in the Stalin period, Soviet army, occupied down in the end of the World War II, ignoring the Japan-Soviet neutral pact. Then they occupied all of the Kurils, including southern three Kurils, just heritageous islands of Japan. This is starting point of Japan, Soviet Russia's not so good relations. But we should think that even the Cold War period, we Japanese never wage war with Soviet Union. It's not so good relations, not friendly, but coexistence continued. So after the collapse of Soviet Union, we are more mutual independence. So in this sense, despite of the bad histories and not so good relations, at least, particularly in the post-Cold War period, Japanese and Russia enjoyed not so bad time, rather happy time than before. But now it's break up.
And the, I think, again, for broader context for listeners, the history of conflict between Japan and Russia was essentially, as you say, the war of 1904-1905, which I think had enormous resonance across the region, partly because of the message that sent to a lot of emerging Asian powers that it was possible to confront and even defeat or bring to terms a European imperial power. But also, of course, the conflict between Imperial Japan and Russia in the broader Second World War, and the fact that when, if you like, that war ended globally, the territorial issue was not resolved between Japan and Russia, particularly with Russia's occupation of the islands of what Japan would see as its northern territories. Do you see that as being an issue that just needs to be permanently put aside, or is that an issue that at some point will have a resolution?
This is a good question. The Premier Abe Shinzo factually tried to resolve the territorial disputes issue. But finally, he with regret failed to do that. Vladimir Putin, never want even one island back to Japan. This is a reality we now face. Even COVID-19 did not happen. Even Russia's war with Ukraine did not happen. The situation never be changed. So in that sense, the Japan and the Russian relations, for the time being, in a shorter period, no hope. But nevertheless, we are neighbors in the geopolitical sense. So how to manage the challenging situation? This is our mission to seek a new future.
Other neighbors of Russia, and I'm thinking, for example, the Baltic states, Finland and so forth, this year have seen the invasion of Ukraine as a reason for them to look much more robustly to their own security, their own defenses. What's the perception in Japan? Is there a perception that Russia has become a more threatening power in Asia as well as in Europe, or is it more complex than that?
I think that Russia traditionally has two different profiles toward East and West. For Russia, the West is a top priority every time. So now the Russia showed strongly the toughness on the Western front. But before the Russian war with Ukraine, the Russian always with good face to East. This is completely different faces to East and West. So in that sense, I guess many Russians have questioned why Japanese so much criticize Russia. This is because of Western story. We never influence the relation with Japan. Why Kishida criticize Russia so much? Probably they do not understand well. So in that sense, in Eastern Front, for the time being, we do not care about threat at all. But future is a different profile. I had a good Chinese friend working with Russian studies. So back to the early 90s, my good Chinese friend said to me, why Japanese government now seriously try to resolve the territorial disputes? Not so serious for Japan, because China those days made a great mutual concession on the island issues. They also had 4,000 kilometers borders. China also had a concession, but Japan never had a concession. Four islands. Chinese friend criticized me. I just replied, I'm not a government guy. This is not my business. But why Chinese friend said to me so? Now it's an unbelievable period of Russian foreign policy. Russia has come back. It's a very soft Russia. We never saw that. In 10 years, Russia's back to the strongness, aggressiveness. Chinese front is right. Therefore, they had a deal until 2004 to finish all of the border disputes between China and Russia. We, Japanese, failed that. So in this sense, some East European countries also right. If now we do not join the NATO, Russia's back. Now Russia is back. So I guess next generation, what Chinese researchers think of the future Russia? Russia might be back to East. They never remember the 1960s confrontation.
Between
Qianbao Dao issues. So I think that some Chinese experts, even now, are uneasy about future Russians' orientation back to East.
We'll be right back.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's come back to China-Russia relations. That's, a globally significant issue that we need a better understanding of, because there is a perception that that's a fundamental challenge, that relationship to a rules-based international order. That's one strong view. But on Japan-Russia relations, I just want to press you one more time about the question of whether Japan perceives Russia to be a security challenge, a risk, a threat. The harassment of Japanese forces by Russian aircraft, in particular, the scrambling of Air Force. The incident recently, the arrest, the detention of a Japanese diplomat in Vladivostok. How do you interpret those kinds of episodes? And how does the Japanese policy establishment interpret that? Should you be worried?
These 10 years before the Russian invasion, such kind of things happened. Mm-hmm. So in Vladivostok, a couple of years ago, our correspondent, Japanese correspondent, also arrested and to the expel. The scrambles on the Hokkaido air somewhere, these are always daily. So it bit much more than before. But I don't think too serious. Rather, China's presence is care concern for Japan government and Japanese people.
And if China is the number one security challenge for Japan, then how do you see the China-Russia relationship as a strategic challenge?
A great question. 10 years ago, so many researchers, including the Japanese diplomat, wanted to make deals between Russia and China, at least keep Russia away from China. Therefore, particularly back to the 2000s, late 2000s, even the United States State Department expert thought Russia was not a revisionist country. They said, they did not say name China, but in Asia Pacific, there were revisionist country. Russia should be a potential for partner with us. Japanese foreign policy guys, similar opinion. Therefore, they want to have Russia involved with U.S. Japan side. But it failed. Russia and China has a different open mutual relations. As I told you, by 2004, Russia and China successfully completed disputed border areas by mutual concession. After that, for Russia, for China, they didn't care much about long, long borders, then China can concentrate more on south. It means that maritime zone presence. Russia is also pay much attention to western front. But this kind of relations is a basis. Of course, they have different national interests. So it's a kind of quash alliance, I think. But it's not so strong relations yet.
They like to give the impression that it's a strong partnership. You know, the extraordinary agreement that was signed in February this year, the supposedly forever friendship that they have, or the no limits partnership, I think is the English translation they kind of talked about. The energy relationship. There was, of course, for many years, a very close relationship in the weapons industry and armaments, although increasingly China reverse engineered from Russia.
You're right.
There's so many elements there. So is it just an illusion? Is it a phantom?
I said that the Quash Alliance,
yeah,
not alliance itself.
Yeah, so quasi alliance.
If really alliance, then the China should start war to support more in armed bases. The Quash Alliance, it means that it's a different interest. They understand each other, but unite the same front against same so-called enemy.
So how would Russia support China if China got into confrontation with Japan or with the United States or with Taiwan? If China got into confrontation in East Asia, what would Russia do?
No. At least one knows that they do not have full capability to do suppose so in that thing. And the other thing that the Russia does not want to be involved in Eastern confront, as I told you, the Russia has different profile to East. Of course, they show a goodwill, the good pose to China and to do something. But they also keep away from this kind of incidents because they should pay much more attention to West. It's China the same. China's top priority of this South maritime borderlands, including Border Sea or in Taiwan. And Chinese do not have an interest to join the war with Russia. So of course, they showed a goodwill and pose something against sanctions. This is true. It's a quasi alliance level. But China also doesn't want to be involved in the Russian war. No interest.
So in that case, how do you think the Chinese leadership feels now regarding the agreement with Putin? In my view, catastrophic folly of Putin's decision to invade Ukraine and to push that invasion so aggressively. Does China feel that it has made a mistake, do you think, in getting so close to Russia?
Officially, yes. One reason is that once Xi Jinping clearly says the support for Putin, it's difficult to retract about this saying. But for the national interest level, as I told you, that they have a different interest. If they more strongly support Russia, the sanction came U.S. or Europe, Japan to China, it's a serious damage to Chinese national interests. They want to abate that kind of the orientation. Secondly, it's a psychological thinking. As I suggested, these many Chinese researchers on Russia criticized Russian behavior. I guess they thought Russians' invasion is too brutal, not civilized manner. But they never say it openly. But of course, within the regime, within the party channel, they should discuss about it.
So your sense is there is
criticism
inside China.
Therefore, there are many guys want China not to lean on Russia so much.
So do you think from here, I mean, it's very hard to predict what comes next in this awful conflict, but do you anticipate that China will not strengthen its support for Russia from here, that Putin's got everything he can get?
You love the history. Back to the history of the collapse of the Soviet Union. What did China Communist Party discuss? One good thing, no threat disappeared. Great for China. Bad thing, only China should face up against the United States. This is the challenge. So it means that weaker, too weak Russia, not good for China. But too strong Russia is also not good for China in that sense. Therefore, China should rescue Russia at least the minimum level as a partner against the United States. So the China, of course, never want Russia completely defeated, too weak Russia. So I think that China would try to navigate between the two scenarios, so to keep the situation.
I think that's a very sound analysis, but in practical terms, it's difficult to understand what that means immediately. Does that mean some kind of economic support? Does it mean potentially breaching the international sanctions regime? How would China ensure that Putin is not defeated?
I don't think that China can't work as a mediator in that sense. I think that rather India can do it. Because India is a very, very well balanced player in international relations. So India foreign minister came to the Australia recently, but the Australian pay much attention to the kind of Quad relations. Oh, India, why not so serious work in the Quad? But I have another idea. India was a member of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So India blocked some consensus of the SCO. Last month, in Samarkand, they had a conference. As you know, the Modi, Premier of India, criticized Putin. It's a famous history. But resolution itself, so three resolutions of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. One is food security. Second is energy security. Third is One Belt, One Road. These three, India never signed. I think that this is the first time in the SCO history. Because first two, food security or energy security, they criticized sanctions without name. It means that they criticized US or West sanctions. But India never joined. The third one, in One Belt, One Road, the SCO supported. But India did not write it. So the India is very well balanced. So I think that they are now the time Indians presence.
That's an interesting testimony, I think, to the independence and the agency of India as a power in global affairs, because I think there is sometimes some false assumptions that India is either entirely becoming aligned with the United States through the Quad, or that India is somehow never going to be reliable as a partner because of its own desire to have a reasonably close relationship with Russia. And I think your analysis points to a much more interesting future for India.
Yeah, please check the SCO site on the English information.
Yeah.
You can check it.
Okay, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Wrong. And that's useful too, because again, a lot of simplistic interpretation of India's membership of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, sometimes posits India as somehow choosing that as a new form of alignment against the West.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your analysis says that's not true. Can I finish with just two questions about, firstly about Russia, and then finally, I guess your own reflection, if I may, on the legacy of the late former Japanese Prime Minister Abe, because of course the tragic death of Prime Minister Abe this year is something that has really marked this phase in Japanese history. But on Russia itself, you are a Russia specialist, and so we're recording this conversation in October 2022 at probably a crucial point of the Ukraine invasion by Putin. The question now is that Ukraine is pushing back very, forcefully, very formidably, very capably. There has not been the kind of fatigue in Ukraine or its democratic supporters that perhaps Putin was hoping for. Russia is doing very poorly on the conventional battlefield. There are fears being expressed that Putin may escalate in some way, for example, or indeed most grievously, with the use of nuclear weapons. What do you think about Putin's choices now? What do you think his choices are, and what would the consequences be?
I can't exclude 100% of the possibility of use of tactical nuclear weapons.
You can't exclude it 100%.
It means that I can't say that Putin never use.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of nothing about 100%.
Yeah.
But I think that Putin would not use that, because we look at the Russians' revenge after the Crimea bridge was broken down, and the conventional weapons attack missiles so seriously. And this is the first step we illustrated. And if Putin uses the nuclear weapon, even in tactical, China and India would change its position, and so many Asian countries, African countries, still not want involved to be in the conflict. Of course, criticize Putin. Well, it means that complete isolation of Russia in the world. It's also great risk. And of course, NATO's United States suggests and serious counters. So it's working as a deterrent still. But we do not look down the Russian capability. You love the history. Back to the history of Russia, Soviet Union. They are many times almost defeated, but they would be back. So the current situation, Russia's aggressiveness is very clear. Therefore, anti-war, the novel atmosphere of the Russian armies, Russian peoples. But once Ukraine deeply went into the real Russians' territories, Crimea is a kind of a test. It's like a bridge, but more like Crimea itself. Russians again unite much more and to save their territories. Then confrontation has long lasted.
But that depends then where, I guess, Ukraine and its supporters draw the line when they say, that's it. That's victory.
This is Putin's aim. Putin says that mobilization of the peoples more, and threat by possible use of nuclear weapons. I think that it sets signal to the NATO not to support Ukraine more. This is a line of tolerance.
Do you see? Before I go to the question about Prime Minister Abe, do you see a kind of a resolution to the Ukraine conflict, or do you see it, I think, as something that's going to be permanently a friction, permanently unresolved? What do you see?
The current situation?
Yeah. How do you see it?
I think that, of course, the line would be changed either by force. But this situation almost fixed. And in 10 years at least. So I called it a new Cold War. So the post-Cold War, happy 30 years, I said, ended completely. Post-Cold War period, we never use this term. I prefer use the interglacial period, because the interwar period, 1-2 Greater War, and First Cold War, Second War, between the kind of the ice ages. So in that sense, we should prepare for the long term, the tensions and fixed confrontation, even not so hot.
So an interglacial period, I like that. It's a really powerful metaphor, powerful image. To conclude our conversation, any observations on what you see as the legacy of Abe Shinzo in foreign policy, in security policy, and in Japan's future?
This is a tough question. Abe Shinzo passed away recently. I hesitate to criticize him so much, particularly with before falling people's. But I'm a bit surprised couple of days after arrival of Australia in Sydney. Some researchers, very respected Abe Shinzo's foreign policy. I'm a bit shocked because he had a good deal with so many countries, but except neighbor countries. So the worst is for Russia. He met Putin 27 times. It's good for meeting so many times, but his aim to serve the Northern Territory issues completely failed. The second is with Korea, South Korea. The current situation in Japan surrounded so three evils, if a bit exaggeration, the Russia, China, North Korea. Japan's serious challenges. Then why we now quarrel with South Korea, potential good partner vis-a-vis the United States, with the United States. But of course, Korea use historical issues to press Japan. But Japan has a former colonialist country of Korea. We had some responsibility to do manage seriously. But Abe Shinzo's foreign policy completely push South Korea on the wall. They cut some economic privileges relations. So now the Japan, South Korean ties are very bad. China, I do not want to say. No meeting official. So we, Japan, should now recreate the neighbor countries policy. We love the distant powers, greater powers, United States, Australia, Europe, but our relations in the neighbors is very bad. So I wish our Minister Kishida Fumio to make, reshape our neighborhood foreign policy.
Look, I think that adds a really important counterpoint in the conversation about the not only the legacy of Prime Minister Abe, but also the path of Japanese foreign policy in recent years and recent decades. I think from an Australian perspective, we've welcomed the great strengthening of Australia-Japan relations. We've welcomed the Quad, the championing of the Indo-Pacific idea, and so forth. And it's interesting that you talk or that you hint that China-Japan relations are not what they could be. Some in Australia look at Japan and say we would actually like the Australia-China relationship to have more of the balance that
I think
that Japan
it's
has.
A kind of a different part of the relations. A Quad depends on the kind of a democracy camp, not geopolitically so much. Of course, geopolitically has some multiple meanings, but in usually, countries care neighbors. It's better for any country to create not friendly, but not bad relation with neighbors. But now Japan is lack of. Of course, therefore, we keeping the good Quad greater and also plus neighborhood foreign policy, I mean.
Look, thank you, Professor Iwashitara. I think that's a really nice point to conclude on, that theme about ensuring balanced relationships for countries that are in difficult, contested regions. And I think apart from everything else, including your insights into Russia, you've demonstrated that the foreign policy debate in Japan is alive and well. So thank you very much for joining us on
thank
the National
you
Security Podcast.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.